okay, I will call the committee on, Joint Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight and Public Safety Finance Division to order. And today we are going to be discussing the Legislative Auditor's Report on the Public Defender's System. And I think I can speak for both committees when we wish Chair Hillstrom luck on taking the bar over the next 2 days. So with that, if we could have Mr. Nobles and Junad, come to the testifiers table and explain the Legislative Auditor's Report. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the Legislative Auditor for the State of Minnesota, and with me at the table is Deborah Junad, who was the manager of our evaluation of the Public Defender System. I think everyone in this room would agree that public defenders are an essential part of our criminal justice system. They fulfill a constitutional requirement that legal counsel be provided to those who cannot afford a private attorney. In addition, public defenders can help facilitate the orderly movement of cases through our trial courts. Because public defenders are important, in 1992, 18 years ago, the Office of the Legislative Auditor evaluated the system. That evaluation came just a few years after the state was beginning a transition toward a more unified state-funded trial court system. And legislators wanted to know how the public defender system was faring in that transition. We found a troubling situation in 1992. The public defender system was experiencing significant financial stress and organizational conflict. Some of that conflict resulted from judges and local officials who were resisting the whole movement toward a state trial court system. I think it is fair to say that 18 years ago, in 1992, the state's ability to effectively create and manage a statewide public defender system was still in doubt. 18 years later, we conducted another evaluation. And as is often the case with our evaluations, we come to you with mixed results, but I think with a somewhat more positive report. We did not find that in the court system we have yet achieved uniformity in the administrative practices of the trial courts. Judges and local court officials still have their own ways of doing things, and that does have an impact on the public defender system. Nevertheless, the Board of Public Defense, Mr. Stewart, the Chief Public Defender, who was here, as was I, 18 years ago, and Mr. Kyer, who was also here, and he's, as you know, the Chief Administrator for the system, they have made real progress in creating a more unified and statewide public defender system. But the financial pressures that we found 18 years ago have not abated. If anything, they've gotten more severe. And unfortunately, some of the management reforms and improvements that still need to be made will be difficult to make without additional resources. To tell you more about the progress and the problems that we found, I would like to now call on Deb Junad to present our report. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Junad.
Madam Chair, I'm Deb Junad. I'm Program Evaluation Manager with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And thank you for having us here today to talk about our public defender evaluation. I'm going to start with where we're going. Important messages from our report include that practices for appointing a public defender and ordering cost sharing are inequitable around the state. High public defender workloads are impeding public defenders' ability to represent their clients and court efficiency. Supervision of public defenders needs to be strengthened, and Minnesota faces risks associated with its heavy reliance on part-time public defenders, and those risks need to be addressed. I'll come back to each of these issues in turn, but let me start with some basics. The right to legal representation derives from both the federal and state constitutions. Our evaluation focused exclusively on the state public defender system. The right to a public defender applies to those who are unable to afford a private attorney. In Minnesota, Public defenders are available in criminal matters that carry a chance of incarceration, juvenile delinquency cases, and child protection cases. And public defenders represent both adults and juveniles age 10 or over. Minnesota has a state-operated public defender system. And if you turn to page 19 in your report, if you have full copies, looks like this, you'll see that administration of Minnesota's system is divided into 10 districts that align with Minnesota's judicial districts. There are 29 public defender offices, main offices in each district, and some satellite offices located around the state. And those offices house supervisors and the public defender office support functions. Minnesota has about 450 attorneys. Half of them are full-time and half are part-time. And the part-time public defenders are state employees. They're covered by the public defender labor agreement. They generally work half or three-quarter time for the state and also have private practice responsibilities on the side. As I said, we had some concerns about eligibility, the process for appointing a public defender. So let me turn now to what the law says about eligibility for a public defender in Minnesota. Responsibility for appointing a public defender rests with district court judges. And the key standard involved is whether or not the defendant or applicant for public defender is able to pay reasonable costs for a private attorney. In Minnesota, there are two general ways to meet that requirement. The first is that recipients of means-tested public benefits are automatically eligible for a public defender. That applies to the defendant or a dependent of the defendant who lives in the same household. The amount of the benefits doesn't matter. This is like yes-no eligibility criteria based on receipt of means-tested assistance. The second way to qualify is for a judge to determine through any combination of liquid assets and current income that the applicant cannot afford a private attorney. State law provides for two types of cost sharing. Each public defender client is required to pay a $75 co-payment that can be waived by the judge. And plus, the judge may order those with some financial means to make a reimbursement payment to the state that is intended to offset at least some of the costs of their public defense. Overall, we were convinced from our work that the vast majority of public defender clients are very poor. But we did find weaknesses in the eligibility determination process that I'd like to outline for you now. Receipt of public assistance should be, I think, a relatively straightforward eligibility criteria, but we found that wasn't always the case. We identified instances in which recipients of public assistance were not granted a public defender. There are a couple of issues behind that. One, staff misunderstanding of the law, in particular, disregarding dependents who are receiving means-tested public assistance that would qualify that applicant for a public defender. The state application is not widely used, and we saw local district court applications that were structured in many different ways. And those applications really weren't often structured in a way to elicit information easily about an applicant's status as a public assistance recipient. For example, the application some applications didn't list many of the programs that would qualify an applicant, or some asked for the amount of benefits rather than a yes-no answer. And it's possible that an applicant who didn't know the amount would just leave everything blank. And in fact, we did find evidence that applicants are inaccurately self-reporting their status as a public assistance recipient. We asked the Department of Human Services to review about 100 applications that we had, looking in their system to see if the applicant was actually receiving benefits in the month that they had applied for a public defender. And we found that in 20% of the cases, applicants were receiving benefits in the month of application but did not report it on their applications. We also observed some public assistance recipients who were subject to additional screening even though their qualifications had already been identified by their public assistance status. Let me turn now to the second way for a public defender to be appointed, and that is for a judge to determine that the applicant's financial situation is such that they can't afford an attorney. State law allows judges considerable discretion in doing that. The law establishes several factors that should be considered, obviously income, assets that might be available to secure a loan or that could be sold to help pay for the cost of representation. But judges' reports told us that they weigh these factors very, very differently. For example, some judges compare an applicant's income to federal poverty guidelines. Others adjust income based on the applicant's household expenses. Some judges placed a great deal of weight on ownership of a home. Others didn't consider this asset at all in their determinations. We also found that between court staff and district judges that the scrutiny applied to applications varied widely, from basically rubber stamping a request for a public defender to districts where court staff routinely do a face-to-face quick screening interview with each applicant. In the end, we heard from judges that they basically rely on gut instinct quite often when making a decision to appoint a public defender. I'm going to turn now to the practice
of real quick. I don't know if you, when you're in your greens, if I have to call you sergeant or representative, so why don't you clarify that for me too, sir?
You can just continue to call me sir.
Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you. Did you find any disparity between metro jurisdictions versus rural jurisdictions or other areas in greater Minnesota in determining these practices between the two ways of considering eligibility?
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, there were some differences. We didn't test specifically in our application review, for example, between metro and outstate differences. I think we found more differences in the way that some of the other issues with funding, for example, play out between urban and rural public defenders. That was more noticeable in the way they do their work and the challenges that they face. But I couldn't give you a breakdown by judge because really there were 300 different ways, not just by district.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Proceed. Oh, Representative Raskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The inaccurate self-reporting, were we able to characterize or differentiate between people or individuals who had, just gotten it wrong in the reporting of their enrollment in these programs for public assistance, or may have some been misrepresented intentionally? Were we able to get a feel for any of that?
Madam Chair, Representative, we didn't get a lot of information, we couldn't say anything about the motivations of the applicants. Most of the errors, the vast majority of errors that we found, were in the direction of the applicant receiving benefits but not reporting it. So they should have been automatically eligible. Among those that we found were actually receiving benefits, two were denied a public defender, and they should have been automatically granted. I don't know the extent to which actually, I do. There were only two examples, I believe, in our sample in which someone said they were receiving benefits,
but were not,
according to the Department of Human Services. So really, the biggest issue was underreporting of one's eligibility for public defender.
Thank you.
Representative Lesh?
I forgot this question. In my experience, I've heard in determining eligibility, or this may be even mentioned by a judge, well, you had a job, so you shouldn't qualify, but you just got arrested and you didn't show up for work this morning, so you're probably fired and you don't have a job, right? And the routine answer is yes. and, you know, we don't really know if they still have a job or not and shouldn't qualify. Did you run into that at all, and to what extent?
Ms. Jeanette?
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, yes, we did run into individual attitudes at varying degrees of leniency, I guess. Some judges told us specifically that they lean towards appointing a public defender, push come to shove. There were others who said that they definitely tended to be more skeptical than some of their peers. They weren't shy about sharing the fact that they do differ as individuals.
Madam Chair, if members are interested in a little more detail, if you turn to page 54, we cover this issue of the individual attitude of judges. And again, just to echo what Ms. Jeanette said, I mean, judges were not afraid at all to indicate to us, although we were providing them with some level of confidentiality, so we won't name individuals, but certainly they were not shy about saying that they do use their own discretion and judgment, and that their individual attitudes bear upon their decision. And I think, too, what Ms. Jeanette was saying as well is that judges want the cases to move through the court, and not appointing a public defender in some cases may create some complexities that hold things up. So if there's a bias on the part of the judge, and it appears that the person may qualify for a wide range of reasons, the judge is probably more interested in making sure that the case moves on.
Representative Jackson?
It sounds as if the underreporting was easy enough to catch by just verification with the Department of Human Services, but what about cases of not reporting assets or income that they actually had? Was there any way for you to find out how often that happened?
Madam Chair, Representative, we couldn't quantify that. We do know that we did not encounter any districts that do routine verification, third-party verification of reports of income or assets. For example, asking for tax returns or pay stubs. We were told judges will on occasion appoint a public defender on the condition that the applicant then return with some verification of their income or assets. But that's not a routine practice, nor is it a routine practice to do any kind of verification with Human Services regarding public assistance status. That's just something we did to try to get a sense of this issue.
Madam Chair, I've got to follow up.
Representative Jackson?
Is there any penalty given for someone who knowingly underreported and it was discovered after the fact? I mean, who received the services of a public defender, and I'm assuming this application is in form of an affidavit. Is there any penalty for that?
Madam Chair, Representative Jackson, yes, I believe there is. The applicant has to basically swear under oath that the information that they're providing is accurate. The penalty for lying to the judge, I'm not quite sure exactly what that is. There are probably attorneys here who know.
Representative Lesh, and then Representative Eastland, did you have your hand up?
No.
Okay, sorry. Representative Lesh.
Thank you.
I thought I said.
Were you able to track down if there was ever a case of felony perjury or any kind of charge filed against someone who was dishonest on one of these forms?
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I don't know. We didn't ask.
Thank you.
Before we continue any further, I know for those of us that were in Chair Paymar's committee this morning, there was some issues with the system, and if you do have cell phones, if you can either put them on the airport mode or turn them off, probably be preferable. Go ahead.
Okay, let me turn now to reimbursement for a public defender. In this context, I'm not talking about the $75 copayment that's required from all public defender clients. Here we looked into the extent to which judges order applicants with some financial means to make a payment toward the cost of their public defense. Over the last 3 years, these reimbursement orders have totaled about $500,000 per year. And as with eligibility, we found quite a bit of variation among judges. Some were far more likely to order a client to make reimbursement than others. To illustrate and just get a rough relative sense of how this practice might differ among the districts, We divided the amount of reimbursements ordered over a three-year period divided by the number of cases opened in that district. And as you can see, in the second and fourth districts, that's Ramsey and Hennepin counties, judges rarely ordered reimbursements, whereas in the fifth and eighth, the practice was obviously more common. There's another ripple effect, I guess, from the variation in practices. Minnesota state law requires that receipts from these kinds of reimbursements be distributed to part-time public defenders as a means of offsetting their overhead costs. And not surprisingly, with the judges' practices varying, the amount of these payments that go to part-time public defenders vary widely as well. The money is divided such that the amount that judges order in a district, it stays in that district. So it gets distributed based on the number of part-time public defenders there and the amount that those districts that district's judges order. And you can see here that in fiscal year 2009, among part-time public defenders working three-quarter time, distributions ranged from nothing to over $9,000. As I said earlier, we're convinced that most public defender clients are very poor, but we also think that it's important for Minnesota to demonstrate equal application of the law. And we make a number of recommendations related to eligibility for a public defender. We think the legislature should establish fixed income standards and clarify those circumstances that would warrant a judicial waiver of those standards. We think the procedures for granting automatic eligibility to public assistance recipients needs to be strengthened, and those recipients ought to be exempt from paying reimbursements because they've proven that they're very low income by virtue of their status as a public assistance recipient. We think there should be set standards for who should be required to make reimbursement payments and how much those should be. We think the legislature should require a uniform public defender application and for districts to use some kind of face-to-face screening to ensure that they have good information as possible about an applicant's circumstances. And finally, we think that the legislature should change the law to grant authority for the Board of Public Defense to use those reimbursement receipts as they see fit, rather than having law specifically earmark those receipts for part-time public defenders.
I just got to interrupt you for a second here. Going back to the automatic eligibility for public assistance and the exemption for paying reimbursements, and then setting a standard for those who should make reimbursement payments. So if somebody's on public assistance and they get a job, you guys are saying they don't pay any sort of reimbursement at all? If during the course of their criminal proceeding and they started and they were on public assistance and then during the course they get off, they get a job and are able to pay a little bit of something?
No, I wouldn't say that we're excluding that.
Okay. That's kind of what I was thinking you were meant. So
I think what we're saying is that the procedures that we're talking about that need to be strengthened have to do with the applications themselves.
Okay.
For example, we recommend that we also recommend a statewide application that would more explicitly list out those programs that would qualify an applicant so it's easier for them to identify. And then that at that point, based on their status at that time, if they are receiving benefits, then they don't need to be considered for a reimbursement payment.
And
there's another section of law that applies if their financial circumstances change. There is a requirement that that change be reported to the judge.
Okay.
And that they self-report that as well. And I would think that would continue to apply.
One more, and then I'll let you continue. I'm assuming that the application is designed by the Board of Defense, or is it designed by another judicial standard board?
Madam Chair, right now, state law actually has directed the state public defender to create a state application, and he has done so, and that is available. It's just not used.
Got it. Representative Cornish, did you have a question?
Yes, Madam Chair, and for the testifiers, isn't it true no matter what you come up with here, unless you turn the clamps down on the judges a little bit, that it isn't going to work, because judges don't like to be told what to do. They like a lot of leeway. They don't like their authority being questioned. And so, and if you leave a waiver out there, they'll fill out the, they'll use the waiver. So don't we have to restrict them a little bit to make sure that we don't get somebody that just as soon as they start into their story saying, oh, don't even finish the end of it, I'll give you a public defender. I mean, I've run into that, so.
Mr. Nobles?
Madam Chair, Representative Cornish, I think you're correct. I mean, judges, that we found this, I think it's reflected particularly in the pages I referenced. Judges are kind of rulers in their courtroom, and there is wide variation of practice along many things. We obviously didn't evaluate the whole court system, but I think this evaluation really gives you a window into the court system and the role of the judge and the role of some of the court administrators as well. And absolutely, as ultimately independently elected officials, district court judges are going to expect to have a certain amount of discretion. But as you well know, you put some parameters around that, and you expect them to stay within those. I think this report is a message, in fact, to the courts, to the judges, that there are some issues about the equitable, equal application of the law. And I would assume as officers of the court, as judges, as attorneys, they would be concerned about that, because after all, we are trying to meet a constitutional standard here, and they are in the front lines of helping the state do that. So maybe they didn't realize, since they only operate maybe out of their own courtroom, they didn't realize the amount of variation that exists. And so this report will give them, again, a window into that, and maybe it will change practice, especially if you follow it up with some strengthening of the law.
Mr. Nobles, have you shared this report with Ms. Vogel, the state court administrator's office?
Yes, they were a part of this review as well.
Okay. Proceed.
Madam Chair, if I could just add one more comment about the waivers. To meet constitutional standards, there has to be a way for judges to waive eligibility requirements. That's been ruled in state courts and in federal courts as well. So we couldn't have an absolute fixed income standard for public defender eligibility. Okay, let me turn now to workloads. Bottom line, Minnesota's public defender workloads are too high. Our caseloads right now are double national and state standards. In our surveys, 60% of judges and public defenders said that public defenders' workloads in 2009 were much higher than they had been in 2002. We shadowed public defenders in 8 metro and rural districts, and we found the pace to be absolutely incredible. I'll talk some more about that in just a few minutes, but our site visits really did corroborate what's happening out there in the field.
We actually may have a question, Representative Olin, or do you want to let her finish?
No, I will. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
I'll ask a question now, because it's kind of confusing by the way your report is written, because on this page you make the conclusion workloads are too high, and at the same time on page 28 of your actual report you say the public defender's office has had problems accurately quantifying public defender workloads. That being the case, how exactly can you draw that conclusion?
Madam Chair, Representative Olin, the issues that we raise about quantifying caseloads really has to do with some measurement at the margins. And the issues that we raise having to do, for example, measuring caseloads we think should be done a little bit differently for public defenders who are working in rural areas, and the expectations of their caseloads should be somewhat different than for public defenders who are working in metro areas, in large part because of the traveling distance required per case, that those public defenders working outstate are not going to be able to handle as many cases per day, for example, as in metro. So what we're saying is that caseloads could be more accurately measured if the state conducted a new caseload study that was better designed to pick up on some of those differences in regions, and also to pick up on some changes and how law is practiced now compared to 20 years ago when our caseload standards were set. But that said, we don't think it's of a magnitude that our statement here is false in any way. The caseloads, even if we were to tinker with the measurements according to the suggestions that we make, are still very high, and they're still going to greatly exceed national standards.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifiers, has the public defender position been evaluated by the OLA before?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Nobles?
Yes, Representative Anderson, I mentioned in my opening statement that we did an evaluation 18 years ago in 1992. Was the last time we did an evaluation. It was just shortly after the state was moving toward a unified state-funded trial court system.
Representative Coles?
Thank you, Madam Chair. When we're looking at national standards, are we comparing apples to apples? I mean, do we have, do public defenders in other states cover the same types of cases that our public, or was there any analysis done to, you know, I know we had the issue with CHIPS cases a couple years ago, and, you know, are we talking apples to apples as we look at what we are asking our public defenders to cover here in Minnesota compared to other states?
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, it's probably Fuji apples compared to Macintosh apples. We did do some detailed work looking at standards in 18 other states, and it was very hard for us to, and we ultimately did not report any direct comparisons on caseloads precisely because of the reasons that you're mentioning. Different states define crime differently. Public defenders in some states do have different scope of responsibility, but really the national literature that we reviewed said that caseloads around the country, public defender caseloads are high, growing, and are a concern. Minnesota is not alone in this problem, but I don't have specific numbers that I can share with you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Proceed.
The biggest...
Oh, oops, I'm sorry, Representative Severson. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then just to that point, in terms of percentages, I wonder if you offhand have the number of public attorneys that are assigned to OFPs, custody issues. Are those ordered by the courts as well?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have information to answer that question.
Oh. Yeah, okay. I was just going to say legal aid. Representative Severson does a lot of those.
Thank you.
Yep. Proceed.
Madam Chair, the biggest factor driving workloads is a reduction in public defender staffing. Cost-saving actions in 2008 resulted in the loss of about 50 attorney FTEs from the public defender's office. There are other factors affecting workloads. Various judges and public defenders and others that we interviewed mentioned, for example, that Minnesota has had a general increase or trend toward more severe collateral and criminal consequences associated with crimes. And that makes clients less likely to settle. It requires more zealous advocacy on the part of the public defenders. And that all takes more time.
Somebody has their phone on, if you could turn it off.
In 2008, the Board of Public Defense assessed its priorities and approved a number of actions to deal with these staff reductions. We think those actions were both reasonable and appropriate. For example, the Board of Public Defense eliminated non-mandated services. In particular, public defenders are no longer representing parents in child protection cases, shifting that responsibility to counties. They reduced participation in specialty courts, again, to only those proceedings where a public defender is mandated. They implemented scheduling controls. For example, public defenders aren't going to arraignment hearings in some courts. And they also prioritized case assignments, focusing resources on in-custody clients and those charged with the most serious crimes. To a great extent, our surveys and our site visits focused on how these changes played out in the front lines. And it really came down to issues of time. Public defenders told us, and we saw, that they had little time with clients. Not enough time to build trust, explain the system and charges, discuss options, make decisions. They also had less time overall to prepare cases, For example, interviewing witnesses, performing legal research, drafting motions, requesting investigative support, and all the other things that they need to do to prepare for hearings and trial. In one, I'll give you an example. In one district, we shadowed a public defender who went into the court one morning and received her stack of new cases. And she had about 10 minutes per client. That included introducing herself, evaluating the case, explaining to that client what the options and consequences were, discussing possible plea deals, and then at the end of 10 minutes saying, okay, so what do you want to do? And it was like this, working through those cases. One thing we really saw clearly was that being a public defender isn't for the faint of heart. It's not for those without stamina. And the workload, the pace now is having an impact on morale among Minnesota's public defenders. The shortage of public defenders is also taking its toll on the criminal justice system overall. 50% of the judges that we surveyed for our report said that cases in their courtrooms were moving too slowly. We also asked judges and court administrators what factors most influence the pace of criminal cases through the courts. And by far, the most significant factor they identified was availability of public defenders as affecting the efficiency of their courtrooms. That was ahead of the availability of prosecutors, availability of judges, of the actual number of criminal cases entering the courts. One of the last areas that we looked at, and we talk about mostly in Chapter 2 of the report, were just some general management issues associated with the public defender system. Let me highlight a few of the main messages that we had in this area. First, we think managers need to be more actively supervising assistant public defenders and observing how well they represent their clients. Problem with this, and one of the issues involved, is that most of the supervising or managing attorneys also carry caseloads, and that is limiting their ability to devote time to supervisory responsibilities. Along these lines, we also think the public defender's office needs to develop some performance measures that are actually related or to help define what they mean by quality representation. Many public defenders, generally those that are working part-time, are isolated and working without offices nearby. This limits their access to support services, such as investigation, legal research, that are provided through those public defender offices, and it also limits direct supervision of their performance. Just in general, we think that the public defender's office and the state needs to take a strategic look at our current reliance on our system of part-time public defenders. Right now, about 65% of public defenders in greater Minnesota, outside of Hennepin and Ramsey County, are working part-time. A large portion of them are nearing retirement, and we think there needs to be some forward thinking done on that issue. As I mentioned already, the caseload standards that are used in Minnesota are outdated, and we think when resources are available, updating that caseload study would be a good idea. But I'm going to add just one more complication. A number of our recommendations talk about strategic planning and analysis that is needed in Minnesota, but right now the administrative staff in the public defender's office could be nicely qualified as very lean. They simply don't have the staff resources available to do some of the things that we're suggesting right now.
Okay, someone's phone is still interfering, so I don't know if people have them on or what, but if we could turn them off.
I think it's Joel's pacemaker.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, the recommendations that we made to the Board of Public Defense include defining measures of what quality public defense means, strengthening supervisory practices, taking a strategic look, particularly related to some human resource issues. What are the Minnesota's long-range staffing needs for public defenders? What should our balance of full-time and part-time be? Do we need in Minnesota to have some additional satellite offices available? And we also recommend that when resources are available, that the board authorize a new caseload study.
Okay, we actually have two questions. First, Representative Olin, then Chair Paymar.
I'll pass right now because it was a ways back.
Okay. Are you done with all the recommendations, or did I cut you off?
Madam Chair, that was it, and I just had one more slide, and then I'd be finished.
I'll wait for the last one.
Okay. Proceed, and then Chair Paymar has a question.
Okay.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, looking forward, really, there aren't any easy options for what to do. We certainly think that the Public Defender's Office can make some progress for the administrative recommendations that we've made, and we think the legislature can consider the recommendations regarding eligibility determination. But funding is an issue, and there's no getting around that. It's unlikely that the Public Defender's Office is going to see a significant increase in funding, and in fact, the governor's recommendation came out with another reduction for them. The board has clearly stated that its focus is on client services, and I think the state public defender is going to tell you that given the choice between moving resources from client services to administrative and management issues, they don't want to do that. They want to keep their resources focused where they are out there on the front lines of public defenders. That leaves us on the demand side. There is some relief possible through policy changes that would reduce the demand or the sort of cases going to the courts overall. And I'm sure that you've seen numerous proposals already on issues related to civil or criminal consequences, payables list, those sorts of issues. So with that, I'm on my last.
Okay. Chair Paymar.
Well, you know, maybe this isn't fair, Ms. Jannot or Mr. Nobles, because I just, and this isn't the finance division for the public defender system, but, you know, we're probably looking at, best case scenario, another 40 attorneys being eliminated, up to maybe 80. Do you, having investigating the system as you did, I mean, I'm questioning the policy changes. Do you have any recommendations? And what do you see the public defender system looking like if we were to make those kinds of dramatic cuts?
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, it wouldn't look good. I mean, the state public defender can probably speak more specifically about how additional cuts might be implemented. But we already have part-time public defenders who are covering three counties outstate. If you were to take away that public defender representation in some areas of the state, it would become very difficult to provide. Although it has to be. So some way we would be providing public defender services.
Madam Chair and Representative Paymar, I guess I would just add to that I think sometimes when we think about further reductions to public defenders, we think mostly about the clients that they serve, and that's important, but I think we also need to think about the impact of that on the court system, and I think what you've heard from the Chief Justice, what you see in the survey results from the judges that we surveyed and talked to, Undoubtedly, further cuts in the public defender system will have a negative impact on the processing of cases through the courts. And I think the courts are telling you for a wide range of reasons that they feel like the trial court process in particular is really struggling and not moving nearly as quickly as it needs to. And as Ms. Jannot said, judges told us, a majority of them, that it was the availability of public defenders that was having the largest negative impact on the processing of cases. So it's not a pretty picture.
Thank you.
What about in regards to the policy changes you recommended, though? I mean, I think you just both have spoke directly to the finance question that Chair Paymar asked, but you also do make general, and we'll ask the public defenders to come up and talk in a second here, but what do you think the policy recommendations that you're making, how do you think that will affect them?
Well, Madam Chair, we intentionally referenced that without making specific policy recommendations. This was not an evaluation of what the consequences of committing crimes should be. I don't know even if we were to do that evaluation, we would have any better judgment for that than you do. It's a value judgment as much as anything, and you're the elected officials for this people of the state, and it's your prerogative to make those choices. We simply reference it because, obviously, what we learned was that the ratcheting up of the consequences of certain offenses causes people to be less inclined to move their case along, to agree to a plea. But whether you want to reduce those or how you want to handle that is obviously a policy choice. I think Ms. Janad has a reference that...
Madam Chair, as far as we go is page 50 of the report. We listed out some of the recommendations to reform Minnesota's criminal justice system that are already out there and have already been presented to the legislature. And really what we're saying is...
Enforce them.
You know, go forth and consider.
Okay. Any other questions for the auditor's office before we have the public defender and Board of Public Defense come up? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Nobles or Ms. Janad, was there any talk of how many or in your study did you have any chance to make an inquiry on how many people the public defender has repeatedly brought before the courts as far as a repeat offender, how many people continually go through the court system and can continually get represented by a public defender?
Madam Chair, Representative, no, we didn't do any following of repeat clients or recidivism, any kinds of issues with that.
Okay, with that, then we'll ask the Board of Public Defense, Kevin Kyer, and John Stewart from the State Public Defender's Office to come up. I'm assuming you both have maybe a few comments to make about the report.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator with the Board of Public Defense. First of all, I would just like to thank Mr. Nobles and his staff. I think they spent an awful lot of time and an awful lot of effort working on this study. They were very professional and did so with a good deal of humor as well. So it was easy working with them. Just a couple of brief comments. The audit report talks a little bit about doing some long-range planning, and even prior to the audit report coming out, we do have a internal long-term planning committee set up and looking at some of those very issues that came out in the report. Management, full-time offices, a number of those issues about where the system's going to be 3 or 4 or even 10 years down the road. We've also set up internally earlier this fall a quality committee, and I think you heard the auditors talk about the definition of quality representation. I think they found it very difficult to define that, but we are going down that path again internally to do that. On the evaluations, on the performance evaluations, I think one of the things they talk a little bit about in here is our chief public defender work plans. The Board of Public Defense last year adjusted that and has more oversight over that. So I think that's another one of the issues that frankly the board saw. They changed their policy back in 2006, tried it for a couple of years. It didn't seem like it was quite what they had anticipated. And so the involvement of the board, the involvement of the state public defender in terms of those evaluations has been strengthened. Madam Chair, with that, I guess, Mr. Stewart and I would stand for any questions that you or the committee members have.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stewart or Mr. Kyer, I'm going to violate one of those lawyer rules and ask a question I don't know the answer to that I probably should. What, if any, impact have we seen or are we likely to see from the payables list on public defender workloads? Do we have where are we at on that issue, and is that going to provide any relief?
Let me Madam Chair, Representative Coles, let me take a little stab at that. What we have seen in the last 3 or 4 years, We have seen a leveling off of misdemeanor cases, particularly in the metro area. It's actually dipped some. What we have seen, though, is a corresponding increase in the more serious cases, felony and gross misdemeanor cases in particular. How much of that is attributable to a payables list or to a, you know, making some of these things petty offenses, that I don't know. And the court may be able to give you a better idea in terms of the numbers, at least the gross numbers we're talking about. But
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And let me preface the next question or comment by saying that I am not a member who believes that public defenders are overpaid. That said, you know, you've had 50 attorneys that that you've lost, and I suspect there's going to be further budget reductions to the office. And I'm curious what the I'd like you to remind me what the salary settlements were with public defenders most recently, and have there been any discussions about either reopening those or you know, trying to avoid having to lay off quite as many by, and again, I preface that. I see my friend, Mr. Paler, sitting there. I don't believe that our public defenders are in any way, shape, or form overpaid. I'm just curious where things stand.
Madam Chair and Representative Coles, this contract called for a hard freeze. No step increases, no cost of living adjustments for all of the folks, the state employees as well as the Ramsey folks, and a zero and zero for Hennepin as well. So they've already contributed, if you will, by taking a hard freeze this contract period. So any thought of going in to open those up would be, you know, salary reductions.
I have a couple questions, and then we'll get to you, Representative Szymanski. These are more specific after reading the report. How much oversight or follow-up is done with your office and the judges or judicial branch over the reimbursement? So if somebody does get a job in the meantime that they have been appointed a public defender, how much oversight is done to get the reimbursement?
Madam Chair, as you saw in the report, it varies from judicial district to judicial district. It actually varies from county to county within a judicial district. It's mostly a cultural thing, I think, on the part of the bench. Some of those folks firmly believe folks should be paying something towards their public defense. Some folks say no, they're found to be indigent. I think some of you were around several years ago when we had this discussion regarding minimum fines, and in particular in Hennepin and Ramsey, where a lot of times those minimum fines weren't being ordered. Again, I think it's a cultural thing. We have talked to the bench in the past about, you know, looking at these, because they look at the case after it's closed and upon disposition of the case. At one time, we provided each of the judges in the state with a red stamp so they could stamp the folder to say, you know, review for public defender reimbursements. So we did, you know, we did do that. But it's a cultural thing, you know, based on what part of the state you're in. There's no question about that.
The next question we have is, you mentioned your systematic long-term planning. Do you have measured benchmarks or goals that you're taking a look at and reviewing on a regular basis to make sure that if you are not meeting them or you're not meeting your planning, your long-term planning, that you can reevaluate? Is there anything on those lines down in the office?
Sure. Madam Chair, we're doing a couple of things. One is the long-term plan in terms of not so much on the quality issue as to more of what do you want this system to look like, what are the issues that we're facing. I think one of the issues that the auditor mentioned was full-time offices. Our question is, yes, we would love to have more full-time offices. I can tell you three places that we probably should have them that we don't, but for resources. Along with that, we'd like to look at where we place them. If the caseloads have shifted, should we be moving those to other places? And where can we do that? And I'll give you an example. We didn't have a full-time office in Owatonna. We have one now in Owatonna. We've had it for a number of years because they can service four different counties within, I think it's 15 or 20 miles from Owatonna. On the flip side of that, we have a full-time office in Thief River Falls, Minnesota. The reason we have a full-time office in Thief River Falls, Minnesota is we can't find part-time public defenders to do that work up there. So those folks, they take care of five counties going all the way to Roseau and War Road. So they're traveling all the time.
Final question, so, we're getting to Shemansky. Mm-hmm. Are you bringing forth any policy changes in partner with the judicial branch or any sort of policy changes this year that we can work with you on to, you know, either make the system more efficient and more cost-effective? Because obviously Chair Pittmeyer does not have a lot of money and he's going to be cutting more. And so if there's any policy changes that we can be doing together along with the judicial branch to help make the system more efficient, are you bringing forth a proposal based off of this?
Madam Chair, a couple of things in that regard. We have been working with the Chief Justice's, help me out here. The Criminal Justice Forum to look at a number of issues, and as some of you know, there are prosecutors on that, public defenders, county folks, probation people, judges. A lot of this really is a matter of judicial process. We'll have to go through the Rules Committee. You may have heard about the Access and Service Delivery Report that the court's been doing. They've done two studies or two reports. So that I know the Judicial Council has those under review right now. So a lot of those changes, if you will, are really judicial functions. We did have an eligibility bill. I think you all passed it out of this committee last year, or out of the policy committee last year, which is really what the auditor's recommendation is patterned on. And I believe that bill is still in committee. I believe it got returned to committee, so it's still there somewhere. Again, I would caution everybody, I think as the auditor pointed out, that isn't necessarily going to help you a lot. I think, as they found out, the vast majority of clients are in fact eligible, are in fact poor. So the question becomes, how much effort are you all going to put in and everybody else going to put in on something that may have some diminishing returns? So,
and I know it's to that point, but Representative Shemansky has been on the list for quite a while.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can be patient.
Yeah.
All right. Mr. Kyer, in the legislative auditor's report on management issues, it talked about several part-time public defenders nearing retirement age. Do you normally survey them to see what their plans are, their long-range plans, about staying in the system, or is it just a presumption that they're getting up in years and may retire sooner or later?
Madam Chair and members, we do that. Our chief public defenders do that on a fairly regular basis. Obviously, they're in contact with them. We did do a survey of folks a few years ago just to find out where folks are at in terms of age and experience-wise, and you know, kind of what their issues are, plans are. We have kind of an inverted bell curve in terms of our staffing. We have a big group of folks who are new to the system. We also have a big group of folks who are over age 50 or 55, and it does concern us because we're going to have the vast majority of those folks who are over age 50 or 55 are part-time, and as we found out in Thief River Falls and the northwestern part of the state, it's really difficult to replace those people. I think the analogy that I use is several years ago we went through this with doctors in some of the rural areas where we had trouble finding doctors to practice in some of these parts of rural Minnesota. We've tried a couple of things. We brought a bill to you all a couple of years ago about a loan forgiveness program that we wanted to try to put into place in terms of trying to attract some more folks because of student debt. That's one of the huge factors in terms of attracting folks. And we couldn't get that passed. In negotiations with the Teamsters, we tried putting in some kind of a stipend, if you will, or some kind of a one-time payment to attract folks in some of the parts of the state that are a little bit more difficult to find part-timers. We weren't able to get that through on the, at the bargaining table. So it's been a little bit frustrating, to tell you the truth. And it's not something we ignore. It's something we talk about all the time. We just don't have a lot of good answers right now.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to re-ask the question I asked the auditor about repeat offenders, that the caseloads that you carry, how many of those people that are assigned a public defender are repeat offenders?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, we don't really track who's a repeat offender, but anytime you hear about a person recidivating, that's probably our client, because even if they had funds to hire private lawyers on their first offense, by the time they get through the process and commit another crime and get a need for another lawyer, that's likely to be us. We think we handle about 85% of the felony cases in the state. We think we handle over half of the misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor cases. We think we handle just about all the juvenile delinquency cases in the state. And so when you read about a person who's in court over and over again, each time they have a right to have counsel, and that's generally us because they're poor.
Representative Jackson.
It sounds as if one of the recommendations, which is to standardize the application, could ironically result in a larger caseload, which I guess if people are eligible and they need it. I'm wondering, though, on the flip side, even though it's probably a tiny slice, would you recommend any kind of sanction to disincent people who shouldn't be getting a public defender? You know, I've got one anecdotal case from Mille Lacs County, but and I'm sure it's not going to make a big impact, but I'm trying to think of anything that's going to help your caseload.
Madam Chair and Representative Jackson, I think as was hinted by the auditor, these folks could be charged with perjury because they're applying under oath. If I may, I'd like to say, though, that standardizing the application process has some difficulties to it because there are parts of the state where it's more expensive to hire private lawyers than other parts of the state. So it may be that if you're going to get accused of a crime and you want to have a private lawyer, there's certain parts of the state where you should go to and get accused there, and the lawyers will be cheaper because it's a regional market in legal services. So the fact that the judges are different about how they do this, to some extent, there should be a reaction to that. And on the other hand, they are aware of what it costs to hire lawyers in those counties. So it's hard to just come up with a black and white number and say this is it, because it might be workable in some parts of the state but not others, depending on what the number was.
Okay. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stewart, Mr. Carter, could you outline for us kind of how systemically how are you paid, and what is the flow of money from the state in order to pay for this program in its relationship to the defendants?
I was just going to call you Representative Carr. Hi.
Madam Chair, as much as I don't like sitting behind this podium, I'm not sure I'd want to sit behind that table with what you all have to do. But sure, we get the board gets a general fund appropriation from the legislature, and then is charged with the responsibility of dividing that funding up among the 10 judicial districts in our appellate office. In that, there are four standards in the statute that they have at least have to consider: caseloads, geography, results of our weighted caseload study, and I think it's the equity of of compensation between judicial districts, which obviously right now is not an issue given that we have a unionized workforce. So what they do is the board takes a look at caseloads. It also has in the last several years looked at how many extra hours the part-time public defenders are putting in. And usually that's around 40,000 hours a year, and tried to make some accommodation for things like travel time and wait time, those things that occur much more in the multi-county districts than maybe they do in the metro area. So that's how, I mean, that's a general thumbnail of how they do that.
Follow-up, Representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Have you entertained the thought of engaging a piece of maybe defendant applied discipline to the system, and having some sort of preliminary qualification for somebody to get into the system up front, maybe similar to what we have now where the judge says, you know, you can participate in the system, and then putting the onus on the defendant and suggesting that when they are done after the case is adjudicated and they're done with their, you know, your services, that they would become immediately responsible for the full bill. And then at that point, they would apply to the state and prove their qualification for the assistance programs, etc. And then the state would then fund you for their portion, for that portion for which they qualify, and we could have a judgment on them for the balance.
Mr. Stewart or Mr.
Madam Chair, Representative, it sounds like that would add another layer of screeners, because the judges are receiving a completed four-page application from the person now and making the determination of indigency. The legislative auditor found that the vast majority of the people that fill out those forms really are very poor. So then to have, frankly, they're judgment proof. A lot of them. The ones that aren't, we'd be glad to have them pay, but it would be a question of how much additional screening would be cost effective in terms of what you're going to get back from the clients. That's the problem that you face in regard to a lot of these screening efforts. At one point there was a collector in Rochester that managed to collect $10,000 from the clients, which was a good thing, but it turned out that the cost of the collector was $13,000. So I think that would have to be studied to see if it would be cost effective by the time you hired the additional employees to do the second round of screening.
Representative
Vaskowski,
we have Lesh and
Paymark. Thanks, Madam Chair. Mr. Stewart, I mean, the onus would be on the individual, which right now we've got unlimited consumption by these people who are part of who take part of your services, and there's no disincentive essentially for them to participate in your services, and this is what we get, the current situation we have. I'd be interested in talking with you about looking at something that focuses a level of responsibility or discipline of some sort on the individuals. Would you be interested in that?
If I may, Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh has some place to go.
Representative, I got a copy of a letter yesterday from a district court judge in Little Falls who had a public defender report back to the judge that he believed that this proposed client owned 360 acres of land. And the judge ended up writing everybody a two-page letter with a lot of details in it, ordering the person to come back and show every document pertaining to any real estate that he owned. And again, that would be subject to penalties of perjury. So when a person has significant assets and we find it out, we are part of a process to go after that. It's just that so many of these folks are homeless and unemployed and living, many of them living in the streets. So, like I say, the question is, when is it cost-effective to do more screening? I think what this judge did is cost-effective. I think this client is going to either have to hire a private attorney or they're going to pay plenty of reimbursement by the time the court gets through with them. But it's that's an exceptional situation.
Thank you. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, first I preface my comments by saying the number of times I'm in arraignment court or and I ask if anyone's of the individuals on the court calendar, I have to say, if you represent it, I have to say, do you have a private attorney or a public defender? Because some of these guys get the idea that they have a public defender or a real attorney. And I always cringe at that, because if I get in trouble, I'm calling a public defender. They do an extraordinarily better job in the courtroom that I've seen than some of these other individuals that blow in and blow out and collect their check and they're gone. So this caseloads are too high. There's no question about it. They do an extraordinary job. And if you had to gauge the number of public servants who for whom the taxpayers get their full weight, public defenders are definitely near the top. That said, I'd like to know, when determining who actually should qualify for these services that are exemplary, do you know of a situation where anyone has been charged with perjury for falsifying a eligibility form?
Mr. Stewart or Mr.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I haven't heard of a perjury charge for that yet. There have been a number of cases where we've gone back to the judge and the judge has taken the public defender away from the person or has ordered them to pay a substantial payment in reimbursement. But I haven't heard of criminal charges being brought against the person.
Okay.
And Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, just by way of comment, and I do have to leave because in 5 minutes, you guys are being grilled by a panel of legislators. I need to be grilled by a panel of colonels. So I don't know which is worse. But briefly, I think it's worthwhile to be sure. As is stated, the report's pretty sure that the vast majority of people are poor who get public defenders. I think a majority probably are as well. That said, for those individuals, and all the public defenders here are aware of it, it does get frustrating for those individuals who don't qualify but yet do take so many more of the resources. And oftentimes these are individuals that should be paying because they are taking a substantial amount of resources. You know, one of the consequences of committing a crime, as the legislative auditor did say that the intent was not to gauge whether or not the crimes were the consequences of committing a crime were significant enough. Although, in general, one of the consequences are having to pay for legal defense unless you're found to be indigent, and that is removed, as is stated, and sometimes causes a substantial burden among those public defenders that wouldn't otherwise have to deal with that. So, just by way of comments, thank you.
Representative, or Chair Pamer.
Thank you. I'm just curious. I was looking at the options in the legislative auditor's report, and first to Representative Coles, the payables list was dropped out of the conference committee last year. We were trying to expand the payables list to reduce the burden on the court system. The governor would not accept any of the recommendations. Just to bring the committee up to speed on that. But then I'm looking at the recommendations to reform Minnesota's criminal justice system that have been made from 1997 to 2009 from NEAC and on forward. And I'm just curious, if we did implement any of those or some of the ideas that Senator Higgins tried to propose last year in the Senate to decriminalize certain offenses, to start bringing maybe ratcheting down some of the drug offenses that have put so many people in our prisons now, would that actually lessen the load of the public defense system? Because I'm just, you know, they're still committing a crime even if we change the sentencing or it's the whole sentencing guidelines commission, if we if we make radical changes there, that still wouldn't change your caseload, would it?
Madam Chair and Representative Primo, I want to have a quick comment to that, and I know Mr. Stewart would like to as well. If tomorrow you eliminated all misdemeanor cases in the system, just said we're not prosecuting any misdemeanor cases anymore, that's roughly 36% of the cases that we handle. It's about, in terms of workload and weighted caseload, it's about 22%. So it gives you an idea of, again, eliminating every misdemeanor, including domestic assault, including first-time DWI offenders, I mean, all of the whole range of those. So you're looking at, you know, could we use the help? Obviously, and of course we could. But you're looking at a pretty significant chunk of, you know, trying to, you know, what we do. And it's, you have to make some tough decisions. I was just over in the Senate doing a budget presentation, and we talked about priorities. And what are the priorities going to be in a judicial system where we're going to have not only us, but the courts and everybody else are going to have a lot fewer people there. So, but I know Mr. Stewart wanted to...
Madam Chair, but I'm not sure you answered the question. I mean, I don't know. I don't understand how your caseload. I mean, you're just saying that that's a possibility that that public defenders don't provide legal services for misdemeanors. Or are you just saying eliminate misdemeanors?
Madam Chair, Representative Pima, I guess I'm using it as an example of you're talking about, you know, doing some things on the edges, really. I mean, if you're talking about expanding the payables list, if you're talking about making some things petty, all of those things, those are all helpful ideas. But it's not going to solve the problem, if you will. I mean, the nomenclature is we're not going to reform our way out of this budget crisis on a statewide level, and I don't think we'll do it here either. Would it help? Certainly. But again, I don't think you all are going to be sitting in this room talking about reducing felony penalties or eliminating felony cases. So,
Madam Chair, I'm sorry to complain. But even if we did, how would that reduce your caseload?
Madam Chair, Representative Amar, some counties have got diversion programs for first offender felony cases, like check forgeries and damage to property and so on. And those reduce the workload of the public defender substantially because you go in Project Remand or Operation De Novo, all the person has to do is make one appearance for 2 minutes to waive their right to a speedy trial and then go into a restitution program or treatment or whatever. In Hennepin County, 10% of the felonies are taken out of the system by diversion. If you wanted to have a diversion program that would take care of low-level or first-time property offenders or low-level and first-time drug offenders, you could reduce the court time and the public defender time that went into those kind of cases substantially. You know, we've been coming over here talking about diversion for 20 years, and it's implemented in a couple of counties, and there's about 80 counties where there isn't much at all. So that would make a difference. Would it be enough to offset the kind of cuts that are being talked about in the metro section every day? I don't know. But if you did that, and if you took a lot of nonviolent misdemeanor offenses and made them payables, that would be another piece of work that we wouldn't be doing. A few years ago, Representative Bishop had a bill for juvenile petty offenses, and that created a category of juvenile offenses where the people weren't getting a public defender anymore. That was some help to us. It wasn't the, you know, panacea, but person could look at the adult offenses in comparison with the list of juvenile petty offenses. So there are things that could be done that would make a difference. As Mr. Kier says, though, we're still likely to come up short, and we're still likely to come up short in rural areas when we lose some of those part-timers and have people have to drive to cover 9 counties instead of 5 counties.
Thank you.
I would just add as an opinion that then if de novo doesn't work out, then it's about 5 more convictions before they spend time in prison, too. Representative Johnson.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. But it seems clear to me that you folks have been underfunded for more than a few years now, and just looking at the numbers and the statistics. Do you get a sense from the general public that they're picking up on the fact that this is a serious issue that's putting the judicial system in major harm's way, or is it still kind of a silent battle that we're going to see the wake of destruction later on down the line?
Prior.
Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, I think there's a lot of noise out there right now. I mean, you all have been struggling with the GAMC cuts. You've been struggling with a lot of these issues. I think it is starting to resonate with the public. To the extent that it is, I think it's credit to the Chief Justice, frankly, that's kind of elevated this discussion. And he's done a great job of doing that. But like a lot of things that you all do here, it doesn't affect a vast majority of the citizenry. It really doesn't when you think about it. And that's why you're all here, because you are taking on that responsibility. It's a struggle. There's no question about it. But as I said, the Chief Justice certainly has elevated that discussion as he's gone around the state.
Madam Chair, if I may, I'd just add, I go to a kind of a small church, and over the years I've had at least 8 situations where I've ended up advising parents when their kids have been picked up by the police. And when it happens to them, all of a sudden it's noticeable. Yeah. But if it doesn't happen to you or your family, it's not so noticeable.
True statement. Is there any other? That's the end of the list of questions. So do members have any further questions or comments? Seeing none, then meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.